It's Ideasphere with author Craig Nelson, The Age of Radiance.
Before I started working on this book, if you said to me, what does radiation mean to you? I would say infection, sinister, cancer, poison. And I'm sure many people have that idea.
The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era by author Craig Nelson. It's the first full history of the atomic age, from X-rays to Marie Curie, Los Alamos, Hiroshima, mutual assured destruction, Dr. Strangelove, the Nevada test site, and the 2011 meltdown in Japan. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Mr. Nelson, who's also authored Rocket Man and Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations. And he's on the line with me. Thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
You're most certainly welcome. I'd like to begin our discussion just where your book opens up, and that is radiation. It's surrounding us, it's everywhere, and yet we have this innate built-in fear of what this might mean.
Well, I would guess the thing that really shocked me when I first started doing work on this book 5 years ago was, you know, I thought that radiation was very scarce and very dangerous. And then I found out that it's in kitty litter, it's in Brazil nuts, it's in bananas, it's in your microwave oven, it's in your air raid alarm, it's in your smoke detector, it's coming up at us from the ground as uranium decays in the bedrock, it's falling us from the sky in cosmic rays, your pets are radioactive, your family's radioactive, and each one of us is radioactive. And every time we get together, we irradiate each other. So one of my big questions that I wasn't able to follow up on was, is part of human chemistry pheromones, and part of it are these radioactive little subatomic particles and gamma rays passing back and forth between each other. I'm still wondering if that's going on.
At what point is it man created because of our atomic and increased usage of products that emit more radiation?
Well, it actually takes a great deal of radiation to cause serious harm. And the reason why we know that is from two different studies, one with Chernobyl and one with the survivors of the atomic attacks at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. And at Chernobyl, a total of 75 people died in the worst atomic accident of all time, which produced a cloud equivalent to 400 Hiroshimas covering all of Europe. And the reason why that number is smaller than we would guess is that you pretty much had to be on site to get enough radiation to get sick from it. Or the other people who got it were children who drank the milk of tainted cows who didn't leave the evacuation zone. So those were the two people in danger. And as far as we know, no one else had an experience with it. And then the people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they've been studied continuously since 1945 by a joint U.S.-Japan study, and they've only had a 1% increase in cancer that they think is attributable to being at the site. And these weren't people who had a slight exposure to radiation from eating fish from Fukushima. These are people who are attacked with atomic weapons, and they only had this 1%. So I think the risk that we've grown up with and the fear that we've all had for, you know, since 1945 is sort of overwhelming compared to the facts of the case.
Although there is, as I recall reading in your work, the concern that the atomic radiation fallout, I'm talking about Chernobyl, the potential for deaths due to cancer because of that.
Well, the real potential is actually the atomic bomb test that they had in Nevada.
Yes.
And that has now polluted the whole of the United States. So one of the great ironies in this story is that all those years, all those decades, we were afraid of the Soviets bombing us and irradiating us. We got irradiated by our own government, just as the Soviets irradiated their own citizens out of their test facility in Kazakhstan. And apparently, every year, an additional 11,000 Americans will die because of the pollution from those fallout tests.
Mm-hmm. The aha moment, I saw a number in your book where one person is doing something so casually, and suddenly it strikes them that maybe, just maybe, this would work. And I'm thinking of splitting of the atom. How would that possibly happen? But I'd like to step back a moment to your own aha moment when you were looking for the work in this book. You had just written Rocket Man, and then you started thinking about... Yeah.
What I really loved working about Rocket Man was that it was a big history. It goes from Sputnik to landing on the moon. And it's this big, juicy story about science and the government and industry and politics, as well as all these personal dramas about what the astronauts were thinking and what the wives were thinking and what it was actually like to walk on the moon. And there's a lot of great magic of science moment. So I was looking for another giant story like that. And then I found it in Radiance, which, you know, there are so many spectacular things that go on in this story, such as they talk about how plutonium was warm like a puppy, and how when Marie Curie went home to her lab, she would leave the lights off so she could see the radium lighting up on the walls. But then somebody noticed that when she put the radium away, the walls were still lighting up, and the solution at Los Alamos, if you held the little polonium puppy for too long, was called high amputation. So it started off being this miraculous thing, and then people realized what the dangers were later. And that repeated over and over again with X-rays, with Marie Curie's radium, and then again during the atomic age with power plants.
Yeah, and so going back to that aha moment, I'm thinking of one individual. You talk about Leo Szilard. And he was standing at the street corner waiting for the light to change.
One of the great things about these stories is that almost every single significant figure in the history of the science was this sort of outsider in the middle of nowhere. And Szilard is a fantastic case. He's a Hungarian who grew up in Budapest, and he fled anti-Semitic problems in Budapest and ended up in Germany, and then he had to fled anti-Semitism and ended up in London. And while he was in London, and he was actually establishing a charitable organization that would help fleeing Jewish scientists, he was walking down the street, and suddenly it occurred to him that he had just read a novel by H.G. Wells called The World Set Free that talked about bombs made from a uranium-like substance. And Szilard was walking down the street, and it suddenly occurred to him that if you were able to slow down neutron enough to bounce against the atom of the uranium, then it would release itself more nuclei, it would attack more atoms, and it would start a chain reaction. And he realized that this was a terrible danger because scientists in Germany realized this, then Hitler would have the atomic bomb.
Talking with author Craig Nelson, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. The Age of Radiance is now available in hardcover. Previous works include the very well-received Rocket Man, as well as Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations, winner of the Henry Adams Prize. Mr. Nelson, you have a website you'd recommend, a blog or anything else?
Oh, it's craignelson.us.
If you don't have a chance to write that down, we have it posted at Public Radio Exchange, where you can hear this program in its entirety, prx.org. Going back to Szilard and his co-worker Fermi, when they were starting their work, it's surprising that they were able to accomplish very much because they seemed to be at loggerheads so frequently.
It was pretty much the worst couple in the history of science were thrown together because each of them came up with fundamental concept of how to produce fission. Fermi came up with the sort of basic idea, and Szilard came up with some key notions such as that you needed to use graphite as the medium to slow down the neutrons enough so that this would happen. So the two of them were about as opposite as you can get. Fermi really loved doing calculations and figuring things out on the blackboard and then running to the lab and performing scientific investigations in the material world. He was very famous for being the biggest team player on the planet when people were working with this graphite to mill it to make the first nuclear reactor. Fermi was as covered in black dust as anyone else. But Szilard didn't want to get his hands dirty, and he didn't want to do anything that might mess up his clothes. He wanted to sit in the bathtub all day thinking of big new ideas. And he thought Fermi's need to do experimenting was strange. He didn't know why Fermi wanted to get his hands dirty, why he didn't turn this over to junior people. And Fermi thought Szilard was crazy that he didn't want to do experiments. But then Fermi saw Szilard trying to maneuver these greasy graphite and uranium materials and almost dropping them over and over again. And he decided it was just fine to not have him in the lab.
There are so many interesting characters in your work. One that stands out is Madame Curie. what we think we know of her and her life in reality, completely different from what we would think by the history books.
Well, I was really amazed to find out this story because, you know, if you read the first 60 years of biographies and histories of Madame Curie, all you get is that she's this icy, brainiac woman without a heart. There's all this quote from Einstein that she has the soul of a herring and all this kind of stuff. And so one of the amazing things was to learn that after Pierre died, she went on this incredible love affair with one of his students, another acclaimed scientist named Paul Langevin. And everything was perfect. They were really made for each other, except for the fact that Langevin was already married to a woman who did not want to be cuckolded by the most famous woman in France, and whose brother edited a tabloid, and the wife went on a campaign against Marie Curie, and it caused such an international scandal that the Swedish Academy said, well, maybe you should wait and not come this year for your second Nobel Prize. Maybe you should come another time. And that love affair ended quite badly, but Paul, the boyfriend, recommended that Marie hire for her lab a young guy named Fred. And after a year, Fred told Marie that he wanted to marry her daughter, Irene. And Irene was this incredibly plain sort of doer, girl in the shadows of her famous parents type of a person. And Fred was a go-getter. And Marie was so alarmed by this idea that she made Fred sign one of the first prenups in history, saying that if anything happened to the marriage, that the Curies would get to keep all the radium, which is their big treasure that they had. But in fact, Fred and Irene's marriage was so insignificant and their teamwork so great that Marie was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize and Irene was the second, her daughter, her own daughter, was the second woman to win the Nobel Prize. And Fred and Irene came up with artificial radiation, which combined with tracer technology is the foundation of nuclear medicine and is one of the profound benefits of nuclear science and as important for modern medicine as a microscope.
I think that's what's going to make this so interesting for readers is the background of all of these individuals that we've only heard names over the years, and most of us studying the history are lost in the names rather than in their human activities, who they really were. Another one is Lisa Meitner. That is because, and I had no idea, she was very humble. And in fact, one of her earliest discoveries, she really insisted that the professor assisting her would get equal credit. And he was telling her, no, you're the one who made this discovery. You do it.
Yeah, she was almost pathologically withdrawn in a certain way. We don't know anything about her romantic history. She was terribly shy. The biographies we have of her and the letters we have of her are very sparse. But Lisa was referred to by Einstein as our Curie. She was the other famous woman physicist besides Marie Curie. And she ran the physics institute at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for 12 years. She was the first full professor in the history of Germany. She was the second woman to win an advanced degree in the history of Austria. And she was really a groundbreaking woman. And first she was driven out of Germany by the Nazis because her ancestry was Jewish, although she wasn't exactly Jewish herself. And she ended up at Niels Bohr's charity efforts with a guy who didn't like her in Sweden. So she was working for this guy who didn't care for her in Sweden because Niels Bohr made him do it. And she's at having her 60th birthday, and it's Christmas, and she's really glum and really upset. And she goes for a walk in the woods with her nephew. And they're pondering why her partners back in Germany keep splitting uranium and ending up with barium, which is way down the periodic table. Because normally when you assault things with radioactive materials, you produce isotopes that are right next to each other on the table. But Straussmann and Hahn, her ex-partners back in Berlin, were coming up with barium, which is way down the road. So she took out a pencil and a piece of paper, and she thought of Bohr's idea that the uranium nucleus might look like a water droplet, that it might not be this hard, rocky thing we imagine atoms to be. And she calculated if you split it in half and the energy that would be released and how much you would have left over. And the energy that would be released would be E equals MC2, Einstein's formula, and she came up with barium. So she's the woman who discovered fission. And she was written out of history first by the Nazis and then by the post-war Germans who wanted to take the credit to revive their own scientific reputations.
Since she was a Jew, there was no way the Nazi was going to recognize the value of this person.
Right, exactly.
One more then, Roentgen and his X-ray machine didn't name the machine after himself, but what an astounding discovery.
It's a really fantastic story. Wilhelm Roentgen is this 50-year-old physicist working at the hotbed of science, the University of Würzburg, and he and his wife live upstairs from the lab. And at this point, this is the turn of the century, so scientists are, all their labs look like poor men's version of Frankenstein labs because they're all investigating electricity and they're all making vacuum tubes and then charging them to produce colors inside the tubes that they don't quite understand. And they're using these giant generators and batteries to create these enormous sparks that they don't quite understand either. And everyone is trying to investigate what makes electricity and where does it go and what does it do and all of these questions. So what he's doing is, he's taking one of these cathode tubes and putting an enormous amount of power through it and covering it with a piece of black cardboard to make sure nothing can get out of it. And he does this and he turns off all the lights in his lab and he sees something glowing at the other end of the lab every time he charges up this little tube. And he goes over there and it's a screen of platinum that's called a Luxcrem, which is a thing that lights up when it gets hit by atoms. So he can't figure out what's going on with this, but he keeps charging the tube and it keeps happening again and again and again. And at one point, his hand falls between the tube and this Luxcrem. He can see the bones inside his hand. And he thinks he's going insane. So he doesn't tell anyone what's going on for weeks. And finally, his wife goes, I'm really worried about you. What are you doing? So he takes her downstairs and he x-rays her hand for her and shows her the picture. And she shrieks, I've seen my own death. And many in the world call these rays Roentgen rays, but in America we go by the name he gave it, which is X for the unknown X-rays. Mm,
yes. The Age of Radiance, the Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era, author Craig Nelson, New York Times best-selling author of Rocket Man. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with author Craig Nelson, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. I'd like to know what the biggest takeaway you came with after 5 years of working on this book.
Well, the insight that I gained was, first of all, I was really sad that all of these people have sort of had their reputations destroyed because we hate radioactivity so much and think it's so perilous, you know, that our fears about it are much greater than the actual problems that it causes. Like when I mentioned earlier, 11,000 people a year would die from the contamination from the radioactive tests from the Cold War. 16,000 Americans die every year because of air pollution from coal being used in power plants. So the number, when you start looking at these national levels of effects, radiation is nothing compared to petrochemicals. But anyway, I mean, I really think the reason that Marie Curie is this acclaimed woman and no one has any idea what she did is because what she did was invent the term radioactivity and find two radioactive elements and create the foundations of the science. To see something like where Einstein, who is a great pacifist, is now always linked to the atomic bomb is so sad. But anyway, that was very sad to find that all of these scientists have been sort of lost and ignored and fallen by the wayside because of what happened with atomic power and atomic bombs. But the other thing was to find out that so much of what we have taken for granted all these years, and I believed all these things too, or that any radiation is bad for you, and a little tiny bit will produce mutations in your children, and all these kinds of things. It just isn't true. And it was sort of flabbergasting to me that it wasn't more common knowledge.
In fact, you have this one part of the book where the sociologist Rostow, appointed to the chair of the U.S. Institute of Peace by President Reagan, proposed that it was time to give these physicists and engineers, the very ones you're saying are now not considered the best of people, the Nobel Peace Prize.
This is my favorite brain twister. And part of it is the fact that Nobel himself said that his great dream was to create such a terrible device, such a terrible weapon, that it would render war impossible. That was his great dream. And his money from making TNT, from inventing dynamite, funds the prize. So if that's true, then you can say many people really believe that the whole reason the Cold War stayed cold is because everybody had thermonuclear weapons and no one would use them. If you accept those two things as a premise, then in fact, the people who created thermonuclear weapons should get the Nobel Peace Prize. But I don't know if I'm quite ready to accept it myself, but many people do think so.
Well, one of the things Oppenheimer is famous for saying is, "I have become death," which is the Hindu scripture.
Yeah, I think actually he said that after the fact. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, another one was when Szilard was talking with Fermi, and he said, "This is the black day in history of mankind."
The great effort to make the atomic bomb was purely driven from scientists who had emigrated to the United States or Germany, and it was purely done in fear of Hitler having it instead. In fact, the thermonuclear bomb, the hydrogen bomb, or a fusion bomb, was developed because really they were afraid of Stalin having it instead. So it was really driven out of fear. And in fact, that's the only reason anyone has these weapons, is because they're afraid and it's a defensive posture. And in fact, no one has used one since 1945. We're the only people to have used nuclear weapons in war. And that was the other great history that I thought was so interesting, that right after, or I think it's 1947, Oppenheimer gives a speech where he says, "We now must put a lot of imagination to what good is the atom for in war, as in what can you do with atomic bombs on the battlefield?" And no one has figured that out. I think it's driven people crazy. I think it's made the people who manage nuclear weapons insane, because they cannot figure out what they have these spectacular weapons and they can't do anything with them.
Again, The Age of Radiance is the book, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Age. Craig Nelson, the book is available in hardcover from Scribner Press. You have that website?
It's craignelson.us.
We'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. One of the interesting characters, too, is one we're very familiar with, and that's General Groves. He's been portrayed in novels and books and interesting movies that had his likeness. But I didn't realize he was totally against being taken out of combat and putting into a situation what he felt was more like being a nursemaid.
Well, he had just finished building the Pentagon. And so he really was the guy to take on a giant project such as this. But he was getting ready to go serve overseas in combat in Europe. And they show up and say, "Well, you finished that giant project. Now we want you to do this giant project." And he almost lost his mind. He almost quit on the spot. But they gave him a promotion, and he went out to hire Lawrence, who had invented the cyclotron. And Lawrence didn't want the job, but Oppenheimer really did. And they became one of the most unusual teams in the history of American politics or science.
Yes.
And for all of Groves' negative qualities, he could be a pretty nasty character, and he hounded Leo Szilard like a maniac. I still don't understand what he had against Szilard, but he was convinced that Szilard was a spy and needed to be driven out of the country or interned as an enemy alien. And I don't know why he thought that. But the amazing thing that he did was he kept the atomic bomb secret all those years. And it's an incredible achievement when you realize that at the end of the war, there were something like 6,000 people working at Los Alamos alone. as though it was this gigantic project on this huge scale. And of course, you had all the people working in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and in Hanford, Washington, producing the fuel to make the bombs. So it was this massive, massive enterprise, and it was a complete secret, and even Truman didn't know about it until right at the end, until just before it was dropped.
Very interesting, too, with the respect that we have General Graves to thank for compartmentalization and budget secrecy that is used extensively now throughout government. He designed it.
Yes, a number of his protégés ended up in the CIA because he was so good at it. But when it's a good thing for the government to have a secret, it is good. Yeah. we're finding out how it's not always a good thing, but there you are.
Very interesting. I appreciated the way you were able to bring all of this together and make it so interesting and readable. Something we should close on is something that you have written about and thought about over the years, and that's the difference between denotation and connotation and how this relates to your work.
Well, this is a funny story because somebody asked me on the radio, did I go to a history school? And I said, oh, Lord, I wish I had gone to the history school. I had to go study crazy French people philosophy. I was deconstructing this and semioticianing that. But one of the things that I learned from that period was that there are two kinds of meaning in the world. Denotation, which is what you get when you look up the dictionary or the encyclopedia, and connotation, which is everything else. It's the poetry and the inference and the illusion and what things mean to each of us individually. And before I started working on this book, if you said to me, what does radiation mean to you? I would say infection, sinister, cancer, poison, and I'm sure many people have that idea. And instead, the denotation is that it's these little atoms that are so obese, they break the bounds of the laws of attraction that bind the material world together and spit out little pieces of themselves, these little subatomic alpha and beta particles, and then a gamma ray, which is like an X-ray, like light. It's a kind of a photon. And so the difference between the denotation and the connotation is, in a way, what the entire history is about.
You're speaking these phrases that will cause a lot of people to freeze up, thinking, oh, this is science. I don't understand science, and it's too hard to understand.
Well, I have the best story for you on that. If someone asked me, well, how can you reconcile quantum mechanics with classical physics? And it's very easy to do. Let's say you're taking a plane ride and you're going over the ocean and you look out and you see a bunch of dots. So being a world-class physicist, you take out your slide rule and you're able to match up what you're seeing with a number of equations and calculate various things about these dots, such as how they appear and disappear, the speed that they're traveling. You really learn plenty about these dots. Then you take out your binoculars and you realize that what you're looking at are white caps, meaning the tops of the waves. So you know all about waves because you know lots of mathematics about waves. We know there's a music of the spheres, but it doesn't seem there's a melody. But it does seem there's a rhythm, and that's the math of waves. So now you're able to do all these other calculations and form an entire other picture of the force going on below you because you know wave mathematics. And that's how something like light can be both a particle and a wave, by the white cap idea, which comes to us from Schrodinger, the guy famous for the kitten, which may or may not be dead. So that's not so hard to follow, I don't think.
Well, Mr. Nelson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
You bet.
I wish you all the best.
Thank you kindly.
My guest for this broadcast, Craig Nelson, The Age of Radiance. If you'd like more information about these programs, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.